Welcome to Writer House Literary Salon.
May 22nd, 2014. Always a Stranger, the Poetry of Refugees and Others on the Margins. Cecilia Lompart discusses her new book, The Wingless, and writing as a way to finding your place in the world. Thanks to our moderator, Associate Editor of the Virginia Quarterly Review, Allison Wright.
Very happy to have Allison Wright as our guest, James Lipton, tonight. Our guest interviewer. Allison is Associate Editor at the Virginia Quarterly Review, and I'm going to let her introduce Cecilia and get out of the way.
Thanks, Rachel. This is Cecilia Lompart. Cecilia was born in Puerto Rico, and we might talk a little bit more about that later. She got her BA from Florida State University and her MFA right here at the University of Virginia. Her collection, The Wingless, is here. It's $14. You cannot get a meal in Charlottesville for $14. I want to see every single one of you up here after the event purchasing this collection and asking her to sign it for you. Cecilia, will you read a little bit for us?
Sure.
Should I read right out of the collection?
Sure. I was trying to decide on my way over here which of the poems best suited the theme for the conversation, and we're going to go with a sort of abstract suiting of that theme. I'll read two really short poems that go together. I call them sister poems. They were written for one another. And the first one is titled What My Loneliness Does, and the second will be titled Where My Loneliness Goes. These are my favorites.
Oh, nice. I didn't even know that.
What My Loneliness Does. Pace sideways on pointed crab feet. Skin me like the quick tongue of a hunting knife. Curl the floorboards. Open like a sail and let the wind fill it like a man given to belly. Migrate through my body to its warmer parts. Wear the mouth of a blow-up doll. Father the bees. Grow roots, then teeth. Like the snow, blanket softly everything. Unfold the days, fold them up again into paper cranes. Where my loneliness goes. Beyond the nest of cricket song, through the sugarcane fields with no machete, out of one moment and into the next, like a person entering the wrong room. Before me, leaving trail, leaving scent, over mountains of fully capsized blue, in the rain, touching the cheek of every woman. Under sky, older still than this one, in the east with a suitcase full of windows.
Thank you. So, James Lipton famously does not pre-interview his subjects. And we did something in between research and pre-interview, which is that Cecilia emailed me some things that she thought might prove fruitful for discussion. And one of the things that I found especially interesting was this concept of growing up bilingual and sort of learning to speak and then learning to write and then discovering poetry and sort of the ways in which all three of those things are different because of the ways that the languages are different and how those interact. And I wondered if you might talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'd love to. So, as was already mentioned, I was born in Puerto Rico, but we moved to the States when I was 2 years old, making me the very first person in my family who wasn't born and raised in Puerto Rico. I was born there, but I was raised in the States. And I suppose that would qualify me as, if Puerto Rico weren't a U.S. territory, as it stands, I'd essentially be a first-generation American, sort of child of an immigrant's kind of situation. But I'm bilingual because I learned both languages as I was learning to speak. So that's kind of like the first step in answering your question, is that As my parents were teaching me how to talk, they were teaching me English and Spanish at the very same time. So I wasn't learning two different languages per se. I was learning one big language that had two words for everything. And my mom loves to tell this story of me as a toddler. I would come up to her and I would sort of tug on her skirt and I'd say, "Mom, what am I speaking right now, English or Spanish?" And she said, "Well, Cecilia, you're speaking English right now, actually." And I'd be like, "Oh, okay." And then I'd like wander off. I'd come back, tug on the skirt again, "Mom, what am I speaking right now, English or Spanish?" And this time it would be Spanish. She's like, "Now you're speaking in Spanish." It was a little bit easier once I actually entered school. And all of a sudden, that's where the rift began. That's where the divide began. It was easier to acknowledge that Spanish was what we predominantly spoke at home, what the television and the soap operas were blaring in the background, what church, we went to Spanish churches, so what, you know, religion was in Spanish, Christmas was in Spanish, family gatherings were in Spanish. English was school, was friends, was socializing, and learning to read. Not that I didn't have books in Spanish, but I was being educated in English. And something that is interesting that happened around this time is that I think I made it through kindergarten, but in the first grade they put me in speech therapy because I had an accent. Because if I listen to cassette tapes of myself as a child, if I'm young enough and I'm speaking English, you hear a very thick Hispanic accent. And then all of a sudden the accent disappears. And it's because in the matter of 1 year within speech therapy, they flattened my accent, which is why to this day I sound completely, when I'm speaking English, I have no accent. When I'm speaking Spanish, I have no accent. So that element of bilingualism has obviously stayed with me and has shaped me in different ways. And I've had kind of a love-hate relationship with it throughout my life. You know, I'm simultaneously proud of the fact that I have no accent and ashamed of the fact that I have no accent.
Sure.
And where poetry comes in, I knew I wanted to be a writer from a very young age. I wrote my first short story for school in the first grade and got a little bit of attention for it, and that's sort of like the trigger, you know, you get attention for doing something well and you want to explore just how well you can do that thing. Poetry didn't come into the question until I had moved away from home. It was my first year of undergrad, and I realized that I didn't get homesick. I got culture sick. All of a sudden, I missed the Spanish language. I missed the Spanish food. I missed the warmth. I missed a lot of these things that pertained to my culture. I started calling my grandparents in Puerto Rico way more often. I started buying books of poetry in Spanish, the names that I sort of just plucked right out of the air, Neruda and Lorca, they were the only ones I knew at the time, and I would buy the bilingual version, thinking I was only going to be interested in reading the English version, but found myself reading both versions, of course, because I could, and I remember reading Neruda in English and then in Spanish, and being really bowled over by how beautiful it was in Spanish, in both languages, but particularly in the original language, and feeling at 17 years old for the very first time proud of the fact that I knew Spanish and spoke Spanish. And I think that was one of the first little sparks that poetry lit in my life, was it made me proud of speaking Spanish. And I never anticipated that it would do that, but it did. Here we are.
And do you write in Spanish?
I do and I don't.
Some of this collection, there's some Spanish sprinkled throughout.
There are some words, most notably, I think, is the dedication, which I wrote for my mother and father in English, and right underneath that, y para mi abuela y abuelo, which is, and for my grandfather and grandmother in Spanish. So I sort of nodded to the bilingualism in that. I like, when people ask me this question, I like to say, just because you speak a language doesn't mean you can write poetry in that language. And that goes for being bilingual. I write poetry in English because I read so much poetry in English. And just because I can speak Spanish and I'm a poet doesn't actually equate that I can write poetry in Spanish. I think that I'm starting. I'm sort of very behind. Like my ability to write poetry in Spanish is lagging far behind my ability to write poetry in English. I have every intention of catching it up, but from here until there, it's going to take a lot more of reading poetry in Spanish before I'm fully there. I'm doing translation work, and that is helping a lot, sort of to expedite the process. So the answer to your question is that's the goal, but we're not there yet.
Right, and that's an in between, right? And this concept of in between. And you were talking a little bit about sort of art and place, and the places that art, I think you used the phrase, can flourish, and the differences between, say, a city, which is a very diverse setting, and maybe a more rural setting or a sparse setting, and then what happens in kind of the middle of that, a place where we, maybe a lot of us are more familiar, so sort of suburbia. And it sounds like maybe you've experienced a little bit of all of those places. And how does that inform your work?
Well, when I was writing that to you in my email, I was sort of in the back of my head thinking about a poetry class that I took just a few years back with Gregory Orr. And I don't remember who brought it up, whether it was Gregory Orr himself or a student class, a peer of mine. But someone said, why is it that we never read poetry about suburbia? Why is it being, you know, obviously it's being written in suburbia. Most of us grew up in suburbia, but why is it that isn't sort of as idealized a setting as, say, a really fascinating, scary, interesting, diverse city, or the quiet, isolated, peaceful, rejuvenating countryside? What is it about being in the middle? And that to me is a perfect metaphor for what is it about growing up with a foot in two different cultures, with the not just the fact that I speak Spanish and English, but that I have spent half of my life in Puerto Rico and half of my life in the States, that some of my family members can't speak English and some of my family members can't speak Spanish, and I speak both, that I look neither entirely American nor entirely Hispanic, so people, even just upon meeting me and hearing my name, seeing my face, can't quite pinpoint where it is I'm from or where it is I come from. And I think that I use poetry as a way to address all of those questions. I find all of those questions very difficult, and the more difficult a question is, the less I'm inclined to answer it with plain language, and the more I'm inclined to approach it with poetry, which is a sort of fuller, to me, fuller, more complicated language, which yields fuller and more complicated answers. I think I have forgotten your question.
How this concept of in-between informs your work.
Right.
I think I got it, right? No, you have answered it, but I also think that that leads into this idea of displacement, because feeling like you're in between two places is maybe a feeling that you're in neither place. And I know that you're working right now on at least one particular project in this realm of displacement.
Right. So that, I think the word threshold is a really interesting world. A word that means where two things meet. And even in biology, you know, if in the natural world, the thresholds are the most interesting parts of the world, and there's a biological rule, which I'm forgetting the exact term of, but it's the margin something. It basically states that it's those places in the natural world where two very different environments meet that you have the largest yield and the largest diversity of life. The majority of marine life lives on the margins of the ocean. The most diverse species of birds and insect and small mammals live at that place where the woods meet the meadow. Not the depth, not in the deep meadow or in the deep woods, but in that in between. And even in our own bodies, biologically speaking, our nerves are sort of, they proliferate on our skin, which is where our body meets the outside world. And so that notion of sort of having a foot in both places of the threshold is really fascinating to me. Once I acknowledged that I was a poet, it didn't really end for me there. I had to ask myself, well, why does it matter? Why does it make a difference to anyone else? Obviously it makes a difference to me whether I'm a poet or not, but does it make a difference to anyone else whether I'm a poet or not? And what is it that I can contribute to the world and to the world of poetry beyond poetry itself? Not that it isn't sufficient or enough to just contribute poetry, but what questions am I going to answer along the way? And in asking those sorts of questions, both within my work and outside of my work, led me to discovering the work of some of the folks I mentioned to you, Jerome Rothenberg, who's this poet anthropologist who's best known for compiling an anthology called Technicians of the Sacred. And it's this gorgeous anthology, which I've really just cracked open myself, but he has this notion that poetry isn't just what we can vocalize, put into language, or write down. Poetry is much more than that. And if we expand our definition of what poetry is, it can hold so much more. And so Jerome Rothenberg, goes out and studies all of these indigenous cultures around the world and writes down their poems, but their poems are not just what they're saying. They're not just what they're singing. He's also writing down movements that they're making, the dances, the rituals, and that the entire act of it is poetry. Carolyn Forche and her Poetry of Witness is also a beautiful exploration within the world of poetry of what it means to be a survivor and a poet at the same time. And so in sort of like beginning to come to maturity as a poet myself, I realized I wanted to contribute something of this caliber. And the term poetry of displacement started to float around in my head. And what that means to me is poetry of those who are on the margins, poetry of refugees, immigrants, the children of immigrants, of indigenous peoples, of peoples who are on the economic margins of things, people in our own country, the homeless, those who have gone to live off the grid in sustainable communities, in every way that you can let your imagination, you know, use the word margin and otherness. I would put that under the umbrella term of poetry of displacement. And the reason I think it's important is it's a way, I see poetry as a way of finding your place in the world. And I think that people on the margins who consider themselves displaced in one way or another have a special need to find their place in this world. And so I think poetry is a wonderful way of a wonderful tool for anyone who has ever felt othered to use.
Yes, I was just going to say, I want to open it up to questions from the audience, but one thing that you wrote today really struck me, and that is that you were interested in talking about making the other familiar and that we are all an other to someone else. And I had to pause and look at my computer screen and sort of take a breath, because I just felt this moment of sort of companionship with that statement and with the person who wrote it. And I don't know if you have anything else that you want to say about that right now, or if there's maybe another poem that you want to read before we open it up. But that was something that really spoke to me.
Sure. I think that the words artistic community are kind of a paradox. And the reason I'm saying that is because while community is such a unifying thing, and such a necessarily unifying thing, we need community. Art, we need for the exact opposite reading, for the exact opposite reason. We need art because it is isolating, in a good way. Art is private. You not only create and experience very much art in the privacy of your own home, but even in the middle of a crowded theater or crowded concert hall or museum, when a work of art touches you, it touches you in a place that is so deep that it's an isolated place. It's a very lonely place that only you know, that only you exist in a way, and that only you thought you could reach. And yet, here's this work of art that is reaching you there. And I mean, I think that the word other is, again, another one of those umbrella terms that are so very necessary for us to explore. And that, speaking of anthropology, I learned this sort of recently, which might help to answer the question. When societies were fairly primitive and they weren't interacting with one another, is when you see the greatest sort of spread of polytheistic societies. When societies, you know, say the ancient Egyptians or the ancient Mesopotamians or what have you, when they only knew each other, they glorified the idea of diversity. They glorified the idea of many gods with many faces and many talents. And it was when these societies began to be infiltrated by barbarians, by others, by people coming in to pillage and ravage and overtake, that you see this giant change in trend in the religions of the world. They go from being polytheistic to monotheistic. All of a sudden, it's important to just have one god, one face, one protector. And that, to me, is this beautiful example of why it is we need to celebrate diversity, because diversity is the opposite of fear in that way, to be able to see the beauty in diversity and in the other, as opposed to, you know, what's similar about the other as opposed to what's different about the other, is a banishing of fear in that way. And I'm all about the banishing of fear. I think fear is the biggest impediment to intelligence and to art that there ever was. So in terms of that otherness, I think that every single person, it's almost a prerequisite as an artist. You have to have experienced what it meant to be an other. You have to have at some point known what it meant to be different for you to want to create art or for you to want to explore art. And I don't think we often stop and ask, why is that? Why is it that otherness and art are linked? Why is it that feeling different made me want to create art and then maybe want to reach out to others with this art? In many cases, strangers. You know, we're not content with just showing our art to our familiars and our parents and our friends. We want to show them to complete strangers, and we want to be acknowledged by strangers via the vehicle of our art. And so I guess the question of the otherness for me is just a deeper, further education and exploration of what it means to be an artist and what it means to use art as a method of interconnectivity. And ideally, I mean, I'm a great idealist, and I believe in a perfect world, and I believe in world peace and in world harmony, and I believe that we can get to the point where it's all connected, and we acknowledge that it's all connected, and we've made our peace with the fact that it's all connected. And I see art as being our number one tool in getting there, and poetry in particular. So.
Questions?
When you look in the mirror, how could you tell that you're not a typical American? What would you see that would tell you that you are not a similar person?
I suppose that when I look in the mirror, if I were looking in the mirror and had never been told by anyone else that I didn't look like a typical American, I wouldn't think that at all. I wouldn't think that anyone looked like they belonged anywhere in particular if it weren't for the influx and the influence of media and art and society. And so when I personally look in the mirror, if I look and I say that's not an American standing before me, it's because that's been told to me, that I don't necessarily fit the, you know, and I'm young, but I still grew up in a, being told that your average American boy or girl was blonde and had straight hair and had blue eyes. And, That's what I thought in middle school, and that's what I thought in high school. And it's only been in recent years, I think that we are starting to really break some of those stereotypes. And so, but there is also a grain of truth in it. There is ancestry to be taken into account. My great-grandparents on both sides of my family come directly from Spain, migrated from Spain to Puerto Rico, and there's been very little mingling in the family since then, so almost everyone in my family, myself included, looks like they stepped off of a boat from Spain. And if you look up your stereotypical picture of a flamenco dancer, I see myself. I do see the black hair, the curly hair, the white skin. And yeah, I mean, I definitely don't condone or champion the idea that we necessarily look like we're from one place or another, but it's worth, I think, listening to what people say and looking in the mirror afterwards.
I've talked to you before about doing kind of impromptu type poetry readings outside, here and there. What gives you the freedom to break out of, like, sometimes the ivory tower literary college scene to think about doing that?
I think that, ironically, what gives me that freedom is a great amount of privilege. The fact that I am college educated, that I have a job that pays my bills and gives me enough free time to write poetry on the side, that I have enough of that free time to spend philosophizing what it means to break out of that, to see the ivory tower, to see the necessity of breaking out of it, and to then sort of come full circle by taking to the streets. I think what Charles is referring to is he knows that I have at times, I love giving poetry readings and I love traveling, and I at some point promised myself that I would never visit a city or a new place without giving a poetry reading. There isn't always time to call and advance and schedule something. So 2 years ago, I made a cardboard sign for myself that simply says, "Poet, please help." And if I'm traveling, road tripping, or anywhere, even for just a few hours, I will pick a street corner and I will stand there holding that cardboard sign that says, "Poet, please help." And I do not pretend to be homeless. I do not pretend to be in a great necessity. I dress nice, I smile, I put a flower in my mason jar. But if someone stops and gives me some change or even just asks what's up with this, I take it as an opportunity to talk to people about what it means to be a working artist, the notion of a working artist, and can you really support, why is it that we can't support ourselves as artists? Why is it that I went to college for 9 years and can't get a job as a poet because that job doesn't exist? And whether there is any opportunity for that to change. I believe that there is. I believe that we're a long way from it, but I do believe that we're headed in that direction. And there's always this voice in the back of my head that says, you're not homeless, you ate well today, you have somewhere to take a shower, you have running water, you have shoes on your feet. Never pretend, otherwise. But I think that voice is also important. To acknowledge your privilege is a way to be able to reach out to those that are not privileged. And I think it's important to be able to focus on both worlds at the same time.
We have another question here in the front, and then.
Yes, you talk about how the experience of actually reading a poem or seeing a great play is in a way the opposite of artistic community. It's an experience of isolation. And yet, isn't it really an experience of communing with the poet herself?
100%. I had this experience just a few nights ago where I was sort of sleepily reading some poetry. I was in bed already and I was getting ready to sleep, and I always read poetry before I drift off. And so I was in that fuzzy place where, sort of dreamlike thoughts come to you. And I had a very strange thought. I read a poem, the last verse of which I loved. And I thought, wow, what if I created that last verse and I actually put it out into the universe and that poet picked it up and put it into this poem and wrote it down for me to be reading it right now, and it just came back to me. I don't know where that thought came from, but I think that I would love to bring up Gandhi at this point and his quote of how we're all drops in the ocean. We are all just, you know, a little drop in a very, very, very vast ocean. And if we are able to acknowledge that about ourselves, if we are able to very deeply feel the way we are connected to absolutely everything, everyone in this room, every chair, every tile, the veil becomes much thinner and suffering starts to pass from your life. That so much strife, so much anxiety, so much fear and pain is really just that shell that says you're different from that person, from that person, from that person. And so when I say, you know, that artistic community is sort of the opposite of coming together, I mean it's both. I mean that it's that you have to acknowledge the isolation and the structures that our society has put in place to make you feel isolated, to make you feel different, to then pass on to the other side and feel connected and feel at one with either that poet or that artist or that poem or that work of art. You can feel just as at one with the painting itself as with, you know, the person behind the painting. So I mean that it's the opposite, but I also mean that it's the same, which is a weird thing to say, but
you said that just because you're bilingual doesn't mean you can write poetry in both languages. You write in English, but you also write in Spanish. And if you do, do you see differences between the poems you write in English and Spanish?
I do. I see differences between the poems that I read in English and read in Spanish, which is, I think, important to note. I've noticed that there are certain things that sound really, really, really beautiful in Spanish that sound very plain when you translate them into English. And that makes me wonder, is it that they contain different beauties, these languages, that the Spanish language makes certain things more beautiful and the English language makes other things more beautiful? The fact that, you know, in the Spanish language is one of the gendered languages, so everything has its gender. The moon is female, the sun is male, and that lends a subtle richness to the poetry, because then you can have a very plain sentence with these genders in it, which add dimensions and diversities and complexities, which if you wrote the same sentence in English would flatline because it's missing the genders. So when I write, when I attempt to write poetry in Spanish, I do see that difference. I also see it when I write poetry in English about my family versus when I write poetry in English about other things. There are one, maybe two poems in this actual book that reference my family directly, and they're written in a much plainer language, in a much more direct, straightforward tone or language than the sort of other lyrical, fantastical, surreal poems. And I wonder, is that because I'm being influenced by the Spanish culture and language, or is that because we have to deal with things that are closer to home in simpler words because the subjects themselves are already so heavy and complicated? I hope my goal is eventually to be a bilingual poet as much as I'm a bilingual person, and what I mean by that is I'd love to someday put a book out that had poetry in both English and Spanish in it, and not the same poems, but like this poem was written in English, this poem was written in Spanish, and they reside side by side, and if you're bilingual, you can read the whole book, and if you're not, grab a friend to help you out. I'd love to see that start to happen, not just in my own work, but with bilingual writers and artists everywhere. I think it's.
Final questions? Yeah?
You wrote the fact that you are two libraries of two cultures. You made it in a positive way. It's a good way. Ever so often, especially for teenagers and kids, it's not possible. It's limited. They have a hard time dealing with it. They become like, in the morning I'm this kind of person, at night I'm this kind of person. It's like two separate lives. Is there something you can tell me on how to deal with that, how to make it, what to say or what to do?
Absolutely. I stand before you as a poet, which means that I've crossed on to the other side. And what I mean by that is, I don't think you'll ever encounter a poet who hasn't undergone some sort of existential crisis already and lived. So it was a crisis of its own accord to grow up bilingual. I've experienced feelings of shame coming from both sides of the spectrum. I've been ashamed of my family and how strange they must seem to the rest of the world, and I've been ashamed of the rest of the world because it treats my family differently. And I've teetered back and forth between, you know, all of that. I think that there are very specific examples I could probably bring up. The most drastic one, and I'll share it with you all, even though we don't often share it. When I was in high school, I went to high school for theater. I was often in plays, and I often came home late because of rehearsals. And one day in particular, I didn't come home on time. But there was something going on in the news that week that had everyone on edge. Something about, I don't know if it was a school bus being hijacked or what, it was something strange that had all parents really nervous. And so my mom got really scared that I didn't come home on time. She completely forgot that I had rehearsal, just got absolutely terrified that something had happened, drove to my school, found me backstage in my costume, pulled me into the dressing room. First thing she did was slap my face. That was her reaction. It was just, she had driven to school so overwhelmed by fear that her immediate reaction upon seeing that I was safe was strike me across the face. And the thing is, that is the sort of thing that happens a lot within the Hispanic culture. But when it happened at my high school, in front of all of my teachers and friends, was the first time it all of a sudden became not okay. Because then it's like we're showing a little too much here, and I'm gonna have to come to school the next day and explain a little more than I'm comfortable explaining. And I mean, I could narrate instances like that throughout my childhood and adolescence and teenage years and young adult life, and they continue to happen. Strange things continue to happen where the two cultures meet, and instead of them blending beautifully together, they frizzle, and it's either ugly or scary or confusing. And when I was when I say that I went to undergrad and I was culture sick, that was a surprise. I was so looking forward to leaving my crazy Hispanic family behind. So when I got to college and I missed them, that shocked me. And I asked a lot of hard questions, and I declared myself a Spanish literature minor because I wanted to catch up my Spanish vocabulary. You know, all of a sudden, for the very, very, very first time, I was ashamed that I couldn't read and write and speak as eloquently in Spanish as I could in English. It didn't matter before. Before, I was content to just be eloquent in English, but all of a sudden, it wasn't enough. I realized I had been neglecting a part of my identity. And my very first Spanish literature class, I remember that I was trying so hard to keep up with I had spent years being such a great English literature student. I knew all of the answers. I could speak so well in class, but all of a sudden in Spanish literature, I couldn't. And I actually developed a stutter. And that freaked me out. I started stuttering in class. I started stuttering outside of class. I looked that up. I read that stuttering is very common among bilingual kids. that something about, you know, their brain trying to handle both languages at the same time just jolts them and causes the stutter, which as if they need another thing to deal with.
Did you only stutter in Spanish or also?
I started stuttering in both languages. I started stuttering at work in English, and that's when I was like, what is going on here? But yeah, so even though I stand before you and I, you know, talk about all of this as if it's a very positive experience, it's because I've turned it into a positive experience. It's because I've already gone through the negative, and I want to be able to call myself not just a survivor, but someone who has taken what often drowns people and instead risen because of it. And I have, you know, there are poems in my book which I put in there even though I didn't want to show them to the world. You know, there are all of the wonderful, happy, you know, nature-loving poems in the book, but there are also the scary poems in the book. The poems I was afraid to show my parents, and I put them in there too. And I put them in there in case there are others like me who pick up this book and read it and say, wow, turns out all of those scary things, all of those existential questions, all of those things I was ashamed of, there's no reason to be afraid of them or to shun them or to be ashamed of them.
$14.
Thank you, Cecilia.
Thank you.
I'm going to crowdsource, though. I could read one more poem, read a new one from the book, or I could read a new one.
Read a new one.
New one.
All right. The new one, this is sort of embarrassing, but not really. One day this is going to be completely normal. I'm going to read it off of my phone. I have a poem that I'm very proud of that was recently featured as the poem of the day on poets.org. It's my first, very first poem on poets.org. I'm very privileged to be able to say that. I'm very thankful to them that they published it, that they archived it, really. And it's a poem that was written around the same time that many of these other poems were written, but it didn't go into the book for very specific reasons. Namely that it didn't fit. I grew up in Florida and I moved to Charlottesville because I got into UVA, and exactly 1 year after I moved to Charlottesville, that first summer I spent here was when the Deepwater Horizon oil spill happened. And that was happening really close to home, literally close to home. And I felt such an immense sense of powerlessness. I mean, we all felt powerless when that was happening because we knew all of the muck-ups that were going on with the cleaning efforts and how no one could really get in there and help because there was too much bureaucracy and too much red tape. But I felt powerless too in the sense that that was home and I wasn't there. And so I turned to poetry, as I tend to do, to cope. And what I thought were going to turn out to be really angry activists, like raising my fists at the oil company poems, turned out to be incredibly dreamy, soft poems in the voices of marine animals. And I found that my way of coping was to write these poems as if the marine animals were speaking, and not just speaking to one another and oblivious to what was going on. It was like, that was the way that helped me cope, was to pretend that the marine animals, that it wasn't affecting them, that they were oblivious to this mess that we were making upstairs. And this poem is titled "The Barnacle and the Gray Whale." Said the barnacle, "You enchant me with your carnival of force. Yours is a system of slow. There is you, the pulley, and there is you, the weight. Your eyes wide on a hymn, your deep song, like the turn of that earliest of wheels." Said the whale, I have seen you, little encruster, in that business of fouling the ships. Known, little drum machine, you to tease out food from the drink. Little thimble of chalk and hard water. You could be a callus of whiter skin. You could be a knuckle bone. You who hang on me like a conscience. So that'll be the first poem in the second.